You're listening to Trucking Questions from the Audio Road with Kevin Rutherford. This is the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket. You can ask questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, tax, technology, or anything else about the business of trucking. Here we go. Let's head on down the Audio Road.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show, well, it's all about the business of trucking. We take your calls. We answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, living on the road, health and fitness, working with brokers, buying and selling trucks and trailers, you name it. We'll talk about it here on the air. All you have to do is ask the question. We're going to get to those questions in just a couple minutes. I do have another book, book recommendation for you. I was going to say a book review, but I do the book reviews on my other podcast, and I'll be getting to this one on that podcast here soon. But a book recommendation for you. This one came from Matt, and he recommended it the other day, and I finished it in about a day and a half. It's a lot of the things we've been talking about here and there in health and fitness, the grain-free, low sugars, fermented foods. It takes a lot of those ideas and really wraps them up in a whole lifestyle. And the theme of the book and the title of the book is called Go Wild. And the theme of the book is really the idea of getting back as much as possible to the way we lived before civilization. And it talks about a lot of different areas, not just food. It talks about exercise and being outside more and sleep patterns, but really focusing on how civilization has really screwed up our health in a thousand little ways. And it made so much sense to me. It's like when we talk about fuel mileage, and people always want to know that one thing. What one thing can I do to get better fuel mileage? Well, there isn't one thing. And people want to know, what one thing did you do to get healthier? There isn't one thing. It's dozens, hundreds of things that you do to get healthier. But this book really...
Hey, everybody, this is Lisa. I just want to let you know that Kevin's working with Blog Talk to clear some issues. So hold on a couple minutes. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. We're going to get right to some phone calls. Let's head off to Florida. Mimi, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how are you doing?
Doing great. What can I help you with today?
Looking at buying two trucks, they're both 770s in immaculate condition. They're both 2000s with 12.7s. And both asking two different prices because one had a rebuild 130,000 miles ago, and the other one has not had a rebuild. And the one without the rebuild, I'm still trying to determine if the truck actually has about a million miles or 2 million. And the one that this last one that's a lower price also had a new transmission put in. So I kind of wanted to find out from you if you would recommend I should go with a truck that's already been in frame, and I don't know who did it or how they did it. They don't really have the paperwork for it in front of me, and I know how it was done.
Well, I always prefer it, and we have to look at price, but if I can look at the value of each one and both of them have enough value, then I'd rather control the in-frame myself. I mean, do we even know for sure that it was done? You say there's no paperwork. Is it just somebody telling you it was done?
The seller is telling me he's got some receipts, but, not too much paperwork to back it up.
Yeah, that worries me. We don't know what we're buying then. I mean, some receipts, that doesn't tell me a whole lot. So that, now, it's not to say that I wouldn't buy a truck like that, but I would buy it knowing what I'm that I could be looking at an in-frame. How much do they want for that truck? Let's get down to some numbers.
He's asking 33.
Oh, no way. No way. 33. What year is this?
2000. But it's a 770, and it's immaculate.
All right. But say no way. That bothers me. He's asking a really premium price, which would be fine if we had a documented in frame and we know that it was done right with the right parts. I have a hard time. Now, if you really love the truck and it's really immaculate, and you're willing to take the risk of, you know, this thing might need an in-frame in 12 months. We just don't know. I would offer him maybe 25 tops.
Actually leaning toward the one that has not had the in-frame. But let's just say that the truck actually has never been in-framed and it has 2 million miles on it.
I say almost impossible because I do know of two trucks right now with 1.9 million miles that haven't been touched. But that is so, so unusual. Now, the other thing is, if we're not sure of the mileage on this truck, have you run a rig dig yet?
I did. The man that owns it now, he bought it from someone who told him about 900,000 right now. But when I ran the rig dig 10 years ago, a title transfer said that it had 800,000 miles. So that's where I'm kind of thinking that. Realize how many miles.
Yeah, and that's why we do the rig dig, because we can find evidence like that tells us a little more. Now, the other thing we could do, have you physically seen this truck yet?
He's driving by, and we're actually going to see it in a few hours.
Okay, so what you can do, it really helps if you have two similar trucks. And one of the things that I've done when I'm not sure about mileage is if I can park another truck similar to it, meaning same model, same make, that kind of thing, and you start looking at wear points. You know, you look at the pedals, the brake, clutch, throttle pedal, you look for wear points around doors. You look for things that have repetitive motion and they create wear points. And a lot of times you can see the difference between a truck that has 2 million and 1 million, no matter how good they've been taken care of, by looking around the truck at those wear points. Now, if parts have been replaced, so there's no exact science to this, but that's one way you could do it. Here's the other thing, though. Let's say you look at this truck and we don't know the mileage, but you look at it really well and the condition is good. Well, you know, if you go into this knowing that you may end up replacing all the major components, who really cares how many miles it has on it? If it's solid, if it's not fallen apart, if it's been well taken care of, I know 2 million mile trucks that I'd love to own.
That's what I thought. I've got a local mechanic who comes very well recommended and has a waiting list to do in-frames, and he uses the rebuild kit from Detroit Allison. Is there anything that I need to, if I have him rebuild it, that I should make sure he does? He normally changes the bowl gear also on the 12-7. But somebody said I got to be careful when they do the head, that it shouldn't be ground down and machined. It really should be done by Detroit. But that makes the cost a lot more. Do you have any information on that?
Yeah, it's one of those things that I recommend you do. And it is better to have it done by Detroit. They've got a multi-million-dollar machine they do it with. Now, we don't see as many head problems on the Detroit as we do the CAT. You know, if you don't do the liner protrusion right on the CAT, and a lot of shops don't, we see blown head gaskets all the time. Not quite as much on the Detroits, but my thought is, you know, when you're building a truck like this, you're building it to last. The little bit extra, or sometimes even what looks like a lot extra, really can save you a lot of headaches down the road. Doing the bull gear is an absolute must. I would rather see the head done And I would also, and I don't even know how to say this, but I would really try to stress to him to try to find the best injectors he can possibly find, whatever that means today. Because we're having a lot of injector issues. So if he knows of a better source for injectors, I would pay whatever they would charge me to get better injectors.
And can I squeeze one last one in?
Sure.
He went ahead and changed out the Eaton Fuller that was in there. It was a 179, and he upgraded it to a newer 189. The truck's got the typical 430/500 on that 12.7. Does that affect the ratio? Does that affect fuel mileage or anything, changing out the transmission or upgrading it?
No, usually not. Almost all the transmissions have about the same final gear ratio, whether it's a 9-speed, a 10-speed, a 13-speed, a 15-speed, an 18-speed. The top gear is so close, and that's where we spend 85% of our time is in the top gear, that the transmission has very little impact on fuel economy. And a lot of people think it's going to make a big difference. It really doesn't. In some operations, if you're really heavy and you run a lot of hills, then a 13-speed can make a difference over a 10-speed. But an 18-speed doesn't make much difference over a 13. In fact, really none at all. So there's just not that much difference to worry about. If it's got a newer and upgraded transmission, that's a good thing.
All right, that's it. Thanks, Kevin.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. All right, we are, you know what, we're coming short on time, but I'm going to jump into this call and we'll carry it through the break. Let's head off to Pennsylvania. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I talked to you a week or two ago about a oil sample on a C12, and you gave me some news I really wasn't prepared for. I wanted to...
Okay.
Revisit it and see what my best options are. I just bought this truck, and we looked at the sample and based on the iron and the oxidation and the oil consumption, you said that I'm looking at an in-frame in about a year. And that's kind of shame on me. I did have a sample pulled before I bought it, and I was impatient and lazy. Instead of getting my own sample kit that I usually use, I let the mechanic use the CAT kit, and CAT lost the sample, and we're coming into the break, I hear.
Yeah, so I'm going to take us into the break. I'm going to take a look at these oil samples, and we'll come back and talk about these. So hold on. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to the phone calls. Before the break, I was talking with Brian in Pennsylvania. Brian, you still with me?
Yes.
Okay. So, here's the thing. Even if you would have done an oil sample before you bought it, the odds of us being able to predict that it needed an in-frame would have been difficult. It's the oil consumption that is the most critical factor. Now, one of the things I recommend in my program when I'm talking about buying trucks is an engine blow-by test, which measures crankcase pressure. It's not an exact science, but we can tell close how much wear are on the cylinder kits with by how much pressure is getting down into the crankcase. So if we did an oil sample and if we did a blow-by test, we might have been able to predict this. You know, your oil sample does not look bad at all. We are seeing some elevated wear metals, nothing horrible. The base is dropping and we have some oxidation. And what that tells us is the combustion gases are getting around the rings and into the crankcase. We also know you have oil consumption, fairly heavy, and that is an indication that we have stuff moving by the rings in both directions. The oil's getting from the crankcase up into the combustion chamber. The combustion gases are getting from the combustion chamber down into the crankcase. That tells us we have liner wear and ring wear. I'm only guessing, you know, at a year, if you take care of this, I would keep some Lucas in it, a gallon every oil change. And I would probably say this is one of those engines that I wouldn't try to go, you know, real long on drain intervals. I might do my oil changes between a, I would still put a bypass filter on this truck, but I would do the oil changes at 15,000 miles. And because we're not trying to save money on service right now, we're trying to extend the life of the engine. We have a different objective here. So we're going to spend a little more on the services by replacing not only the full flow filters, but the bypass filters. We're going to do them every 15,000. We're going to dump a gallon of Lucas in. You might buy yourself another half a year, a year. We're only guessing. I just don't know.
Would you also switch to 2050 or just stick with 1540?
I would stick with the 1540. I would rather bring the viscosity up a little bit with Lucas than try to go with the heavier weight oil.
Okay, and then there's another truck. Do I need to see this through an in-frame, or is it possibly a good idea to dump it for something with almost the same specs and price with an N14?
Well, how much do you like this truck? I mean, the C12 is a great engine.
Right. I like it.
What year is this?
It's a 2000.
Yeah, see, this is one of those trucks that I don't see any reason to get rid of it unless, now you're the one driving it, you're the ones with your hands on it. If it's just been abused and it feels like it's going to be a problem truck, then you might want to think about it. But when we have these pre-emission trucks, I like the C12. In fact, I like the C12 a lot. A lot of people would rather have the 15-liter, and in some operations I would too. But if I had this truck and I couldn't find anything really wrong with it, I would just put the money into this one. You already own it.
Okay, that's what I thought. And then I think I know what you're going to say about this too. And I guess you're probably not prepared for this. You'd have to look at my profit gauges, I guess. This is a local operation, and I'm toying with the idea of a slip seat driver, but I'm not sure if the numbers really work. And it would be somebody... Sorry, go ahead.
When you say slip seat, you mean you might run the truck for so many hours a day, and then when you're done, somebody else is going to run it so many hours a day, right?
Right. And somebody I know, somebody who actually kind of mentored me when I was getting started.
Well, let me say this, because I've looked at numbers on operations like this many, many times. I did this for a while at FedEx. We were allowed to do this. We could run our truck in the morning, dispatch it, and again at night. Without looking, you know me, I do almost everything by the numbers, but without having the numbers in front of me right now and some time to look, I can say it's almost impossible to go wrong doing this. It's
okay.
Unless the night work or the whatever night, day, whatever the extra work, unless it pays so poorly, which I kind of doubt that it does. I mean, I'm sure it pays at least average. It's almost impossible not to make this work and to make more money. Here's why. And this is why when you look at your profit gauges report, you see fixed cost and variable cost. So the fixed cost means truck payments, insurance, permits, license, all those things that we have to pay whether the truck moves or not. Variable cost, those go up the more we drive the truck. Your fixed cost, the minute you start driving more miles, paid miles, your fixed cost per mile goes down. So you've already covered all of the fixed cost by running this truck the way you're running it now. So when you look at your profit gauges report, you could say, okay, here's how much profit I'm making, you know, 70 some cents a mile, 50, whatever the number is. And we can wipe out the fixed cost on the next operation. There is no fixed cost. You've already covered those. So it's almost impossible not to profit when you can pick up more work like this.
Okay. Well, I was on the right track there with the fixed cost. I guess my concern is I'm looking at here since I started in February, my total all miles, I'm at $1.65. And of course, I'm running about half the mileage of a over-the-road operation.
Right.
My variable is, I guess, is pretty high. Had some things, you know, go wrong. Just got the truck. I'm at 76 cents a mile variable. 48 fuel and 20 maintenance.
Horrible. That's not horrible for a local operation. It does cost more. You put more wear and tear on a truck. I mean, we could work on that, but it's not horrible. So, but that still leaves you in the 90 plus cent a mile after your variable cost. So let's just use those numbers. Will the extra work that you're going to pick up pay about the same?
Yeah, I would expect, because this guy I have in mind, he likes to work stupid hard. So I expect that he would, you know, have, if the work's there, at least the revenue that I'd generate.
Okay, so let's go with that. Let's not even go with that. Let's say he generates $1.50 a mile instead. And we have those same variable cost of 70 some cents a mile. So now we're down to 80 cents a mile left. But like I said, you have no fixed cost. So you pay him some of that 80 and you still have profit. I don't see how these numbers couldn't work.
Okay. Yeah, I was just concerned because my actual average gross is like $2,300 a week, and sort of ballparking the more recent figures is $2,500. At $2,500, I think it can work. I can pay him 40% of my gross, which would make him $1,000, which is what I want. You know, that sort of, I see that as a minimum for, you know, a company
right.
driver around here. And that leaves me with about 20 cents a mile on 1,200 miles a week, I think I'm doing, which I think is worth it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the truck's already there. I mean, you've done all the work. You own the truck. You've bought the permits. Everything's in place. And to be able to add that kind of revenue, honestly, I never made more money than I made when I slip-seated a truck, when I ran it with two drivers, one in the morning and one at night. It was way better than my team operations even. Because teams, it was always that you're always fighting with drivers and trying to keep good teams together. And I made more money with a single truck running it day and night than I've ever made with a truck.
Okay. Yeah, I guess my only concern was if I had to put them up at 45%, I was seeing myself going back to 10 cents a mile. And then I guess my only other concern is, of course, we're going to wear the truck out twice as quick.
Yeah, but you're covering that in your variable cost.
Right.
See, that's the
okay.
That's the beauty of the numbers is we can go back and calculate all this stuff. And I was using really round figures and I was rounding down, way down. I think there's significant profit in here to run it at night. I really do. And I think you can pay him well so you don't have to worry about losing a driver. And it sounds like you know him well and he's going to work hard. I think you'd be crazy not to do this. Obviously, keep tracking your numbers
And, you know, call me back when, you know, I can pull the numbers up and we'll go over them. Stick around. We'll be right back. Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment, so I'm going to get right back to some phone calls. Let's head off to Ohio. Rick, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. This is good to talk to you again.
What can I help you with today?
I've got a Coronado that I just purchased, and I'm checking to see. I wanted to put an airfoil or an air dam, whatever you would call it, on the top of the truck. And I'm wondering if I should go with a factory installed unit or one of the stainless steel model wing type.
Don't do the wings. And I know it's tempting because of the cost. But once we understand aerodynamics, the wings can actually hurt fuel economy. Very seldom do they ever help much. And sometimes they hurt. And let me try to explain the airflow, and I think you'll be able to picture this. So the goal of aerodynamics, the wind stream, the airflow as close to the vehicle as possible. Anything that makes that air break away from the surface of the vehicle creates turbulence and drag. So if you look at a very, very aerodynamic truck, like a Cascadia Evolution, you can start to picture this. They want that air to stay right on the body of the vehicle, come off of the truck, onto the trailer, and stay there. So when you notice the grill is somewhat tapered back, the hood is tapered towards the windshield is tapered towards the top fairing, and then the top fairing rounds off so that the air flows over it and makes a smooth transition to the top of the trailer. Can you kind of picture that as I'm talking about it?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, what happens with that wing?
Yeah, it changes the whole flow of the air.
It actually sends the air up.
Up, yeah, yeah.
It's pulling it away from the surface of the vehicle, the exact opposite of what we want to do. Now, people look at it and go, oh, yeah, but it's going to hit the wing and not hit the front of the trailer. You're right.
Uh-huh.
It's not going to hit the front of the trailer. So if it hits the front of the trailer, it will break away from the surface down the sides and the top and create turbulence. We know that's bad. But this is almost as bad. It's shooting the air up and breaking it away from the surface of the vehicle. And it's not mounted flush against the top of the vehicle. So now you've got that gap under it. So we've got air rushing through there, creating a new group of turbulent air. So I don't like them at all. I think they're a total waste of money. So
okay.
I know it, what I would look for is a wrecked Coronado or whatever model truck you've got. And I've helped a lot of people do this over the years, and my budget is usually $2,000. That is bought, installed, and painted. And we've got it done for between $1,500 and $2,000 many, many times. At that point, it's absolutely worth it. You could pick up as much as a half mile per gallon, so we can pay off $2,000 in 6 months.
Yeah, okay. Very good. Yeah, I've got one spotted, but I just didn't know because I do like the look of the other one, but functionality, it doesn't work, like you said.
Yeah, once you understand the physics behind the aerodynamics and you stand there and look at it, you go, wow,
It's going to do the exact opposite of what we want it to do.
Correct. Right. Very good, Kevin. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Question, if I could.
Sure. Yep.
The other one would be, it's a glider from Fitzgerald, and I've done my first oil change last weekend, and they stressed to me not to use synthetic oil till at least 50,000 miles. What's your opinion?
That's not a bad idea, and I'll tell you why. If we know that an engine is solid, we could put synthetic in right from the start. It doesn't hurt anything. The reason we don't do it when we build the engine is because we like to do that first oil change at 5,000 miles, just get all that junk out of there. Well, who wants to throw away $30 a gallon oil? The reason I'm okay with waiting is because of the issue I've talked about so many times, where we have had some part supply issues on the 12.7s, and it's not going to hurt us to wait 50,000 miles to make sure the rings seat on this thing and that we don't have excessive oil consumption. And as long as we get to 50,000, we don't see excessive oil consumption, then we know it's safe to go ahead and switch to the synthetic. So, you know, I used to say do it at the first oil change, but it's not going to hurt us to wait.
Okay. Okay. Good, good. The other thing, too, real quick, is the underflow that you guys are marketing now?
Flow Blow, yeah.
Flow Blow, yeah. Is that a pretty good thing for a spread axle flatbed?
It's one of my favorite products right now, and it doesn't matter what trailer you're pulling behind. This is so simple, so well-designed and engineered, inexpensive, and we are just getting amazing feedback about fuel mileage increases.
Okay, good. Well, maybe you can hook me up to either Lisa or whoever. Maybe I can get one ordered.
Will do. I'll put you back on hold, and we will get that taken care of. Let's head off to Ohio. Abdul, welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call, Kevin. I have a question about the free flow air filter, and like 70,000 miles on it. And I washed it this weekend, you know. And I looked online on how much oil to put on. I mean, I know, you know, where the oil goes, you know, because the inner core, you spray them on the outside but facing you, and then the other two ones, you spray them towards the core. But my question is, I don't know how much, you know, oil to put on. So I don't know if I over-oiled or under-oiled. And I was wondering, I have the scan gauge. And you know the intake air.
Yeah.
Is there any way that will show if it's...
No, that's reading intake air temperature. Here's the thing about you know what I try to tell people is we don't want to under oil it. If we under oil it, we run the risk of getting some dirt in. Now, are you doing oil samples?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Okay, so here's the thing. Even if you under-oiled it, as long as you watch your next oil sample coming up, if we don't see a ton of silicon, that's what you're going to look for on your oil sample, silicon. If you see a big jump in silicon, then we probably know you under-oiled it, and we just pull it out, re-oil it, and in that little bit of time, you're not going to do any damage. But I would rather over-oil it. You know, if we get a lot of oil on it, we actually kind of wring it out a little bit. If there's too much oil, we're going to kind of suck it through the system. It's not going to hurt anything. And it will kind of dry itself out. And the worst case is if it's too oiled, we're going to get a little bit of restricted airflow. So I always lean towards over-oiling a little bit rather than under-oiling.
Okay, if that's the case, then I think I over-oiled it a little. But I'll make sure, I'll just make sure I'll check my next oil sample. And if I see silicon, like, what would you say the silicon? I mean, they'll flag it, though, if it's high. And it's never been flagged, so I'll know that's what it is if it gets flagged.
Yeah, and we don't even necessarily have to wait for it to get flagged. But if you just look at the number, and I'm going to guess, most trucks come in under 10. under 10 is a totally safe number. 10 to 20 would indicate that we're getting a little more dirt in there, but it probably won't get flagged at that level. But if you were to see a jump, let's say it was 7 and all of a sudden it's 16, that might be an indication that you might want to pull it out and put a little more oil on it.
Okay, got it. All right, Kevin, thank you so much for your help. I'll continue listening.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's squeeze in another quick one here. Let's go to Georgia. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
I got a couple of steer tires. I wanted your, if you could tell me the rolling resistance on these Bridgestone I've got. They're 283s.
I always get that one mixed up with the 287, so let me go look just to be sure. So you've got the Bridgestone 283 Ecopia, correct?
Don't see that on it. I don't know what that is.
Yes. 283 Ecopia. Okay. It 110. Are you using it as a steer tire, or are you using it everywhere?
Well, here's what I was actually going to ask you, if I could use it everywhere, because I'm planning on buying more of them to put on, so I would add to it if you want to.
Yeah, 110 isn't horrible. I'd like to get closer to 100. That's a good tire, though, and if you wanted to run that one everywhere, you certainly could. That makes a good drive tire, and you'll still see a fuel mileage improvement over most other options. I am all out of time. I've got to get out of here. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you back here next time. Be safe. Be profitable. Do the hard work. And master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Ruth.
Thanks for tuning in to The Audio Road. If you have any questions, give us a call at 855-800-FUEL. That's 855-800-3835. Check out the website at letstruck.com and find us on facebook.com/letstruck.